Here we go in another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. Let's open to the book of Proverbs, chapter 29. We'll pick up at verse 4 in just one moment and remind you that we're in the end of the 700s BC in our chronology as we study through God's Word. It's the time of King Hezekiah. And the reason we're back in the Proverbs at this point is because from 25 on to 31, the Proverbs has this additional publication of information in the time of King Hezekiah. My suspicion is that he began after being granted an additional 15 years of life, began looking for answers for what life was all about. And one of the things that he pursued was wisdom. And so he probably went to the book of Proverbs issued by King Solomon originally, and then his men found additional Proverbs, and so he released all of this together during the late 700s BC. That's my suspicion. And as we go through these, we do just like we did in the original book of Proverbs, and that is understand these are short, pithy sayings. They're intended to be rule of thumb things to help us to learn to live better lives by God's standards. With that in mind, let's begin. Proverbs 29:4. By justice, a king builds up the land. Now, a lot of the things that Solomon would have been thinking about revolved around his own responsibilities to govern properly as king and his son's responsibilities when he came to the throne to govern appropriately. So if you use justice as a king, then you're building the land up. But look at the contrast. Verse 4, part B. But he who exacts gifts tears it down. And the idea of the gifts here seems to be graft, bribery, getting people to kick in to the king's wealth in order to get nice treatment from him. That's not appropriate in a kingdom. It's definitely not appropriate like in a constitutional republic like we live under. Fairness is fairness. Money should never come into whether or not you get treated fairly. And if a leader starts adding that into the equation, well, that's going to just screw everything up. Everything is going to get torn down. Verse number 5. A man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. Flattery is what I call schmoozing here. It's talking people up, trying to convince them to trust you, even though you've got bad intentions toward them. You want to use them. Con artists are major schmoozers. So that's exactly what the proverb says. Anybody that pulls that stuff on their neighbor, they're just trying to lay a trap. That's what they're up to. Watch out for it. Verse number 6, an evil man is ensnared in his transgression, but a righteous man sings and rejoices. So evil people, honestly, lay traps for themselves. Be sure your sin will find you out, right? But if you are a righteous person, you're doing things God's way, then you can be happy as you move through life. You can be rejoiceful as you move through life. Verse 7. A righteous man knows the rights of the poor. A wicked man does not understand such things or such knowledge. Actually, I think it's more the idea they're not interested in understanding such knowledge. A righteous man is actually concerned about his fellow human beings, people made in the image and likeness of God. And when they see people with tough things happening in their life, their heart goes out to them. They want to protect them and help them. But a wicked guy, he's only about himself. And so he sees poor people suffering. So that's on them. Too bad. So sad. Right? And so this proverb, like many others, is trying to encourage being kind and thoughtful toward other people. Verse number 8. Scoffers set a city aflame, but the wise turn away wrath. So troublemakers, they don't care. They'll burn the whole place down if they think it's good for them. Or maybe it's because they're ticked off because things didn't go their way, and so they're like the spoiled brat that destroys the game board because they're losing. They're ready to burn anything down. But wise people, they're thinking ahead, and they're trying to avoid such troubles. You know, how do we keep everything from burning down? Be wise, obviously. Verse 9. I think this is a very important one. I've posted this multiple times as an attitude adjustment on my Facebook page. If a wise man has an argument with a fool, now remember, a fool is not somebody that's deficient of knowledge. It's actually got more to do with their morality. Remember the quotation from the Psalms, "A fool has said in his heart, there is no God." So a fool is basically somebody who rejects authority outside themselves. So if you end up having an argument with such a person, then if you're a wise person, you know how that's going to turn out. The fool only rages and laughs, and there is no quiet. So depending on what you say, the fool is either going to get mad, or they're going to laugh in mockery about what you're trying to say. They're not going to be resolving it with you. They're not interested in resolution. It's all about them. And so I've encouraged people, you know, if you end up coming head on with a fool on social media, don't waste a bunch of effort in trying to fix their problem, because their problem can only be fixed by God, honestly. Verse number 10. Bloodthirsty men hate one who is blameless and seek the life of the upright. Well, that's not good to know, but it is true. Some murderous people out there are particularly hateful toward those that are doing the good things, doing the right things. And it gives them obscene pleasure to take such people down. Verse 11. Another one that I've actually posted is an attitude adjustment scripture. A fool gives vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. So fools pop off. They say whatever comes into their head. They have a knee-jerk reaction, and they're very often very nasty about whatever the topic is. Wise people try to chill. They try to be thoughtful. They think through things. They try not to be instantly reactive, because they want to be guided by God's wisdom. Guess which one we need to be like? Yes, the wise person that's holding back. Verse 12. If a ruler listens to falsehood, so if his tendency is to be open to false information, then all his officials will be wicked, because they will see that whatever he wants to hear, they can tell him and he'll believe it. And so if they've got their own bad agenda, they're just using him to carry that agenda out. It's not a good situation when the leadership up at the top of a country is like a little echo chamber, that they only say the things that each of them want to hear. And it's always negative for the people underneath them. Verse number 13. The poor man and the oppressor. So the guy that's on the short end of the stick and the guy that's holding the stick. The poor man and the oppressor meet together, meaning they have something in common. He who is gives light to the eyes of both. Now, what it means is he's given life to both of them. We've seen similar universal statements about the rich and the poor are also in the same boat where they both die, that sort of thing. So in this case, it's God is there for both sides of this equation, poor and oppressor. Verse number 14. If a king faithfully judges the poor, his throne will be established forever. That's a principle that King Solomon, I think, was trying to put forward for his kids, his sons, one son in particular, his heir that was going to be on the throne after him. And Solomon was writing these things down, speaking these things out during his better years, when he actually was still at least partly in God's camp. And so he says, listen, when kings faithfully judge the poor, God's going to be on his side, God's going to keep him on that throne, and God is going to keep the throne in that family. It's actually something that David was promised, that God was going to be with David's descendants through time. And he would rebuke them when they were in the wrong, and he would encourage them when they were in the right, but that David would never miss having a descendant available for the throne of Israel, right up until the time Jesus comes, who's the final throne holder for the kingdom of Israel. And so the encouragement here is pretty obvious. It's like, do things God's way and things will go well. Verse 15. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. Now, the mention of the rod here is a citation for and about corporal punishment. We're going to use the short term of spanking. So spanking, along with the verbal correction that comes with it, leads to wisdom. We're talking about for a child, a growing child that is being rebellious, being resistant to doing the right thing. A little negative reinforcement helps take care of that. We're not talking about a beating, understand. We're just talking about a very simple form of physical discipline. That helps. I know, I speak from experience. I received such spankings when I should have gotten them. In fact, the truth be told, there were probably some times that I got away without getting what I should have gotten. But the ones that I got helped me move the right direction. The opposite of that is this: a child that is left to himself, basically never corrected, never told that he's doing something wrong, never told that he's got to start doing something right, that sort of person is going to grow up being self-centered and foolish and without any regard for anybody else no regard for authority. And that's why they're going to bring shame to mom. Verse number 16. When the wicked increase, transgression increases. You know, when wicked people are in the ascendancy, then so is wickedness in society. But the righteous will look upon their downfall. Now, the wording here, one of the problems we have in English is it doesn't always catch the complete shades of meaning from the original language. The shades of meaning seem to be that, yes, the wicked, when they're on the ascendancy, they bring more and more sinful things to bear. But that is going to be followed by God's judgment against them. And when they get knocked down by God's judgment, the righteous people are going to look upon that and go, yeah, that is natural. That is why I need to stay righteous. That is why I need to not be wicked. So it is a learning from the judgment that comes against unrighteous people. That's the point of verse 16. Verse 17, discipline your son, and he will give you rest. He will give delight to your heart. Discipline might include corporal punishment in this context. That's true. But the bigger part is training. To encourage your son or your daughter to do the right thing. They'll grow up into adulthood, living that sort of lifestyle, and they will make you happy in your old age. That's the principle being put forward by verse 17. Verse number 18, where there is no prophetic vision, meaning there is no religious instruction, no religious guidance, the people cast off restraint, meaning they just do whatever they feel like doing because nobody's telling them otherwise. That's not good. That's like the time of the judges, right? There was no king in Israel in that time. Everybody did as they saw fit in their own eyes. That's chaos. That's anarchy. So, not good. But blessed is he who keeps the law. Blessed is he who keeps God's word, who pays attention to God's directions for life. That's better. Verse 19. By mere words, a servant is not disciplined, for though he understands, he will not respond. Now, this has got the implication of corporal punishment in it, that there are some servants, some foolish servants, who have no regard for doing things that they are told, when they're told, as they're told. They'll just do whatever they feel like. And so corporal punishment was actually used in that sort of context to say, no, you're being a bad servant. You need to get back on track. Because the implication is sometimes words are not enough to move a foolish person forward. Verse 20. Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? You know, he's quick to pop off. Well, there's more hope for a fool than for him. And we already know that being a fool is not a very hopeful situation. So people that pop off without thinking, you know, put their mouth in motion before putting their gear in, their mind in gear, it's even worse for them. Verse 21. Now, verse 21, we're looking at the English Standard Version, and I was a little puzzled by some of the wording of it, so I went and did extra research on it. And lo and behold, I found out that the Greek translation of this passage from the Hebrew is different than what our version is here with English Standard Version. And it also reminded me that much of the Greek Old Testament translation of the Proverbs it's more paraphrase. It's more thought for thought rather than word for word. And so my version of English Standard Version for this verse actually says that the last part of this verse is uncertain in the Hebrew. All right, let me read to you first from the English Standard Version. Whoever pampers his servant from childhood will in the end find his heir. Now, some people would say, well, that's if you treat your servants like they're your kids, then they're going to respect you, and one of them is going to really be almost like an heir to you. I don't actually think that's the original intention of the Hebrew, and that's because of looking at the Greek text. Here is an English version of the Septuagint from the 3rd century BC. He who lives luxuriously from his childhood will end up being a domestic. So that's considerably different, isn't it? So if you are like full of yourself, pampering yourself ever since you were a kid, it's likely that you're going to go into debt and end up in servitude. The second part of it is this: but in the end, he will be grieved over himself. See, if you end up becoming a slave because of indebtedness, that's not going to make you happy. And so what's the point? The point is, don't be thinking just about yourself when you're young. Don't make it all about you. Think about others and think about where you want to be eventually in your life. I think that is the proper understanding of this particular proverb from the Hebrews. Verse number 22 next. A man of wrath stirs up strife, and one given to anger causes much transgression. None of us are caught off by that. We know that people that have tempers just cause more trouble and more sin. So again, the advice is avoid them or don't be one of them. Verse 23, one's pride will bring him low, but he who is lowly in spirit will obtain honor. So good advice we see in other ways, like humble yourself under the mighty hand of God and he will exalt you at the right time. Correct? Verse 24 and 25 together are also one of those places that is different in the Greek Old Testament. Let's read our English Standard Version first. The partner of a thief, so somebody that is helping a thief out, hates his own life, so he's not looking out for himself. He hears the curse but discloses nothing. The fear of man lays a snare, but whoever trusts in he who is safe. So the way the English Standard Version presents it, it's a couple of different proverbs. The first one has something to do with not being a partner with somebody who's a thief. You know, covering up their sinful activity. And the second one is that being afraid of people is just going to lay a trap for yourself. Fearing the Lord, having respect for him, that's better. Okay, here's an English translation of the Greek Septuagint at this point. He who shares with the thief hates his own soul, and if, having heard an oath proposed, they do not disclose it, since they were afraid and felt shame before people, but they were tripped up, but the one who trusts in he who is will be gladdened. Impiety gives a man a stumble, but he who trusts in his master will be saved. That's considerably different and much more expansive, isn't it? The thought is that if you are in cahoots with a thief, and then you get caught up in the law, and they put you under oath to disclose information, but you're afraid to let the information out because you were involved in it, and you're shamed by this, and you're all messed up, you are definitely in a big mess at that point. You really shouldn't have gone in with the thief to begin with. I think that's the ultimate instruction from this. But in contrast to that is the idea that if you trust God, then you're going to be a better person. And you're not going to get caught up in this sort of stuff. And you will be on better terms with everybody around you, including the people you work for. There seems to be a little intimation in the Septuagint translation here that the theft might have been against an authority figure, a master. And so very interesting to kind of take note of the distinction between the Greek Old Testament translation of the Hebrew and our own modern English translations. Well, a couple more before we finish up today. How about this? Verse 26. Many seek the face of a ruler, that is, petition them, try to get in good with them, get them to do what they want them to do, right? Many seek the face of a ruler, but it is from God that a man gets justice. So he who is the one that has the ability to give us the right things, to give us justice against those that have done the wrong things. And so if we seek the face of a human ruler, the implication is we should seek the face of our divine ruler much more. And then verse 27, an unjust man is an abomination to the righteous. Abomination has something to do with smell and sickening, being made sick by something. So unjust people make righteous people unwell, upset. They don't like to be tied in with that bunch. But one whose way is straight is an abomination to the wicked. Now that's an interesting twist on this proverb, that good people make bad people sick. They don't like it when we do things the right way. And I've found that that tends to be the case, that people that want to do bad things don't want anything to do with me and my morality. Well, that brings us then to the last two chapters in the book of Proverbs, which are interesting in and of themselves, and I will bring up some differences between the Hebrew and the Greek Old Testament the next time we get into the Word.